Start again.
Just for like 5 minutes, we're gonna do Q&A, because I didn't give you a chance to do it this morning. I don't want to get too tied up in Q&A, or we won't cover the material. And that's what we want to do, is cover the material. But let's do 5 minutes, Janine.
I have a question, Dr. Burnham. That sounds like Burnham Harbor.
Burnham Harbor is an architect. Dr. Burnham is a different thing. Burnham Harbor is an architect who designed that. If you don't know if Burnham Harbor is, it's in Chicago, right on the lakefront at Monroe. Okay. Anything else?
You might want to put your email address so that if people do have questions, they can email you.
Yes, I will give you my contact information if you want it. Here. Well, there's nothing to write with, I don't think. Nope. My email is Harlan, H-A-R-L-A-N, 288@gmail.com. That's Harlan, H-A-R-L-A-N, 288@gmail.com. And my phone number is...
What?
What now?
No, I was just laughing like, oh my God, you're about to give your phone number up?
Is that a bad thing?
No, it just blows up.
I can handle it, that's fine. That's okay.
No matter what time?
I don't care.
Wow.
Well, I buy a cell phone, I put it on silent vibrate. So if I'm sleeping, I'll call you when I get up. If I can't talk to you at that second, I'm not ashamed to let it go to voicemail, but I will call you back. 480-495-8961. That's 480-495-8961. That's my phone number, and that is my email address. You can text me at that number. You can call me at that number. That is this phone right here that I'm holding in my hand. Okay.
I have a question.
Sure.
So, in the doctor's opinion, the allergy of the body is definitely mentioned, obviously, because it's talking about, it's a medical estimate. That's why it's there. But in terms of the mental twist and the mental obsession, that's not really talked about in the doctor's opinion.
Most drinkers drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That's the mental twist. That's the mind. That's the mind looking for that effect. It's not the body. The body comes into play after the substance is inside of us. The body cannot come into play with it, and the allergy will not be activated unless the substance is already inside you. So the mind brings us to the solution of the food, and the food triggers up the allergy. The mind drags me to the food, makes by the hair, it makes it, it's irresistible for me. I cannot take the pain of not eating. When I'm not eating, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. Throw in scared to death, angry as hell, jealous, suicidal, whatever you want to throw in there. So the mind drags me to the food triggers the allergy, and the allergy makes it impossible for me to stop. Now, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in their mind rather than their body. So I must work my program. If I don't work the steps, I will not be able to maintain any type of recovery. Yes?
I had a question about working the steps.
Yes.
I've heard, I'm not that long in the program, but I've heard that if you, when you work the steps, you're not finished at 12, you start over.
Well, you do 10, 11, and 12 for the rest of your life, and that'll take you through all the steps. You should be doing 10s throughout the day, 11 at night, 11 in the morning, and 12. And then by doing that, you'll go through all the steps every single day, many, many times. 10, 11, and 12 will bring you through it. Yes?
Where do the traditions fit in with your program?
The traditions, you just follow them. They came about in the 1940s after the book was written. But I follow the traditions to the best of my ability. I'm not perfect, but I try not to violate them. Yes?
Would you repeat how to do the steps, what you just said?
10, 11, and 12. You do 10s throughout the day, to do 11 at night and 11 in the morning, and do 12s. You're going to be working all the steps all the time. 10 will encompass... 12,
by doing 12s?
10s, 11s, and 12s, you will embody the entire 12-step program. 10, 11, and 12. One more. One more. Go. Okay.
Did Young weigh in on what psychic change? Once the 12 steps where Alcoholics Anonymous became this group, did Young weigh in on the psychic, that this was the psychic change indeed, or could be in terms of doing the 12 steps?
No, but he and Bill Wilson communicated quite readily, and there is many letters that went back and forth between Carl Jung and Bill Wilson. Many, many communications went back and forth. And Bill also communicated with Sam Shoemaker quite a bit, Father Ed, Father Dowling, a Jesuit priest in St. Louis, was a very dear friend. There's a book about the relationship between Father Ed and Bill. I can't name it. It's not a conference-approved book, but you can look in, you can look online, and you'll find it. But the bottom line is that Bill communicated with a lot of these people. He really communicated with Ed, and he communicated with Shoemaker. Matter of fact, if you listen to old tapes of AA World Conventions, Sam Shoemaker was one of the speakers in a lot of them. And we're going to find out the reason why here in about 5 minutes. But Father Ed was very instrumental in Bill's faith. As a matter of fact, the 1955 convention of AA was held in St. Louis, Missouri, because Bill was afraid that Ed was dying. And Father Ed, by the way, encouraged Bill to start a program called Fatties Anonymous, because he said, your cross to bear is liquor, mine is butter, sugar, you know, that kind of thing. And he encouraged him to start Fatties Anonymous, and Bill said, that's not my issue. It's, you know, I'm not going to do that. He says, that's not my issue. And Father Ed was very precious to Bill Wilson. Very precious to Bill Wilson. So Bill had a lot of communication between him and Carl Jung. Okay? Now, we're going to talk about Chapter 5. We have not got the time to go through 2, 3, and 4. We're going to talk about Chapter 5, page 58. When Bill Wilson and the group were writing the book, at some point Bill knew that there would have to be some very specific instructions as to what to do, when to do it, how to do it. And the instructions are all through the book. There's instructions throughout it. We have already worked steps 1 and 2 today. Step 1, 2, and 3 are not working steps, they are conclusions of the mind. And if you conclude in your mind that you're powerless over food and your life's unmanageable, you've worked step 1. If you conclude in your mind that you've come to believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity, you've worked step 2. Now you have to keep working them, but these are steps 1 and 2. Now we're going to look at this chapter, and the first 4 chapters were written, and Bill knew that he was going to have to write Chapter 5, How It Works. And he said that he knew that he wanted to close some of the loopholes that these alcoholics were jumping through. And he never set out to write 12 steps. He said that he liked the fact that it came out to 12, because 12 is a significant number in Bibles, and 12 is a significant number in a lot of other things. He was very happy about that. And when he was writing Chapter 5, he was nocturnal at that time of his life. He would sleep all day and be up all night. Wasn't working. And he said that it seemed as if the pencil took on a life of its own. And in less than 20 minutes, he wrote one of the most unbelievable pieces of spiritual literature within one of the most important pieces of spiritual literature that the world has ever seen, Chapter 5. There was a new puke, a new AA member. AA really hadn't even formed yet. But a new AA member came by, saw the light on, came up to Bill Wilson's house at 182 Clinton Street in Brooklyn. He came up there, and Bill says, look at the new 12 steps. And this guy said, what in the hell are you doing? He says, six steps has always been, up till now, just fine. What do we need 12 steps for? And the fight was on. The argument was on. The Akron groups wanted more God. The New York groups wanted more of a psychological book. And the fight was on. Akron wanted more cowbell, I mean more God. Akron wanted more God, more God, more cowbell. And New York wanted less. And so there were arguments. And what we have today is a compromise of the groups. And Bill eventually said, I'm tired of you fighting. I'm tired of all this bickering and this, all this quarreling back and forth. You want to, you finish the book. And they said, no, we want you to write the book, but remember, it's not your book, it's our book. And what we have here is the compromise that was made between New York and Akron and Bill as the sort of umpire between everybody. Before we even begin How It Works, Chapter 5, remember that I told you that Sam Shoemaker's shadow looms large over our program. Sam taught the boys that there were four impediments to God. What is an impediment? An impediment is something that stops or slows progress. The four impediments to God are a resentment that you will not let go of. Step 4. A secret that you will not tell. Step 5. A vicarious thrill that you will not stop. 6 and 7. And a restitution that you will not make. 8 and 9.
You say them again.
The first impediment is a resentment that you will not let go of. The second impediment is a secret that you will not tell. The third impediment is a vicarious thrill that you will not stop. And the fourth is a restitution or an amends, as we know it today, an amends that you will not make. Very often, when I see people or hear people that are calling me up, and they've been around these rooms for a long time, and they cannot or will not put together any time of abstinence, normally it's these things that are coming to rear their ugly heads. They have justified in their mind that their former wife or their former husband or their former employer harmed them more than was harmed, but then they harmed the other person, and they will not make that amends. Or they have a resentment that they just will not let go of. Or they just won't stop a vicarious thrill. What's a vicarious thrill? Stealing, gossiping, lying, cheating. Those are vicarious thrills, 6 and 7. So these are the things that can get in our way. Let's go to page 58. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Now, what is he talking about being honest about? Well, everything is a very clear answer. Yes, we have to be honest about everything. But what is the most important subject matter I can be honest about with myself? And that is step 1, that I am a compulsive overeater and my life is unmanageable. that there's never going to be a day when I'm going to wake up as a normal eater. I may eat normally today, but I am not a normal eater. The idea that somehow, someday, we will be able to control and enjoy our drinking has to be smashed. Does that sound familiar to some of you? That's chapter 3? Chapter 4? Chapter 3? Excuse me. But the bottom line is, I either believe that I'm a compulsive overeater or I don't believe I'm a compulsive overeater. So when he talks about being honest, he is talking about, because by this time in the book, I either believe it or I don't. Do I believe that I am a compulsive overeater? And do I believe that there is a power greater than myself which will restore me to sanity? It's not sane to eat a whole pan of Sara Lee brownies when you weigh 400 pounds and you're 21 years old, or 500 pounds and you're 21, 22 years old. It's not sane to eat a gallon of ice cream at a sitting. It's not sane to drive around with no auto insurance. It's not sane to drive around when you haven't made a car payment because you're eating the money. It's not sane to not pay your rent. It's not sane to weigh what I weigh. It's not sane at all. It is insane behavior. It's insane. 58. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. If you've decided you want what we have, what is it we have? Remember when I went back there and we did the little scenario with Janine? What does Janine have that I seem to want? That she's not eating compulsively? There's people at Dunkin' Donuts right now that are not eating compulsively. There are people at McDonald's that are not eating compulsively right now. They have their hamburger, they have their small fries, and they have their drink or their coffee, and they're done, they're good. They're eating at McDonald's, which is something I don't want to do for myself, but they're not compulsively eating. What I want that she has is she is a compulsive overeater, and she's not eating, and she is doing so happily. That she's not fighting food, she's not fighting the world, she doesn't have her dukes up with the Tootsie Rolls and all that other stuff, because I can't fight food for very long. I don't know about you, I can't do it. Eventually, I'm going to succumb. Eventually, I'm going to give in, and I will not be able to stay out of the food for any length of time. If you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, what are you willing to do and when are you willing to do it? Now, obviously, you've showed a lot of willingness by coming here. Obviously, you've showed a lot of willingness because I assume this costs money. What'd you guys drop to come here? 20 bucks? 10 bucks. That's a bargain. My God. When you figure in my airfare and my meals and my hotel, I bet you're going to lose money. At that rate, no? Yeah, I don't know. It's not up to me, but I bet you guys are going to, plus you got to pay for the room, and there's a lot of service work that goes involved here, and Amy and Janine have been schlepping me around the whole time, and so I thank you for your service. And by the way, the Valentine's Day thing is a nice touch. I have someone to celebrate Valentine's with this year for the first time in a long, long time, longer than I care to remember. I'm very happy about that. Okay, then you are ready to take certain steps. Some of these we balked. What does balk mean? We hesitated. Although we could find, we thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Now, what is the reason that we're going to stop here for just a minute? Because what is the book telling me? I'm either doing this or I'm not. Now, this is a weird comparison or a weird analogy, but I'm going to use it because it's the only thing that makes sense to me. You know how you hear love is a reed, or love is a tender reed, or love is an ocean, or love is a thing? Recovery is a vending machine. If the product in the vending machine costs a dollar and I put in 99 cents, what's going to come out?
Nothing.
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. 99 cents is close, but I've either put in the money or I have not put in the money. There is no middle ground. I'm either in recovery or I am dancing with a gorilla. And you know when you're dancing with a gorilla, when are you done? When the gorilla says you're done. So I am going to either be in recovery or I'm going to be dancing with a gorilla, and the gorilla is going to determine where my life goes, and I don't want that. I don't want that. With all the, or we thought we could find it, we could not. With all the earnestness of our command, all earnestness of at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Look at your capital letters. We're talking about God. Half measures availed us half a recovery? Nope. Half measures, thank you. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Let's go to page 263 in the fourth edition. 263. Fourth edition. Now, these were the six steps that they were working. 263 in the fourth edition. 263, fourth edition. What were the six steps that they were working before this was written? Number one, complete deflation. Number two, dependence and guidance from a higher power. Number three, moral inventory. Number four, confession. Number five, restitution. Number six, continued work with other alcoholics. There were also the four absolutes of the Oxford group, and it was absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. And these drunks were having problems being anything except absolutely drunk. And it was very difficult. And these kind of... Now, just to do one other thing before we move on. This isn't vital to your recovery, but it's good information if you like that kind of thing. The steps are divided into four sections. Step one is admission. Steps two through seven is submission. Eight and nine, restitution. And 10, 11, and 12, reconstruction.
Can you please repeat that?
Number step one is admission. Steps two through seven is submission. Steps eight and nine, restitution. And steps 10, 11, and 12 is construction. You can say reconstruction or construction. In my case, it's construction because what I had before was garbage. My life before was just garbage. Okay? Let's go to page 60. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is, we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. You can see the compromise in that paragraph. On the page before, pages before, he's telling you, this is it, this is it, this is it, this is it. And now it's, we're not saints, don't worry, we're not, you know, whatever. This is part of the compromise. Our description of the alcoholic, that's chapters, the doctor's opinion, 1, 2, 3. The chapter to the agnostic, chapter 4. And our personal adventures before and after made clear three pertinent ideas. And we're going to talk about the ABCs in a way, and you hear them every meeting, unless you're still out in the parking lot or still whatever. We hear them at every meeting that we go to. But I'm going to do the best I can to amplify them for you today so that maybe you can see them in a very different light, and hopefully it will help you a little bit. Step A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. Well, if you're an alcoholic, we have to know what that means. If we know what that means we have a twist of the mind and an allergy of the body. Twist of the mind, allergy of the body, and could not manage our own lives. I am not managing my own life when I'm fighting food. I am only managing my own life when I am in recovery. So it is vital for me to understand that for me, recovery is the only way for me to live. Okay? Now, let's take a look at B. B is an easy one to miss. Right? Did we do A? My brain is not functioning. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Now, sometimes if you're anything like me, you get this idea that if I had a ton of money, one of your neighbors here in Santa Barbara, she's got more money than God. She's got houses in Hawaii and houses here and houses in Chicago and houses God knows where. That's one of your neighbors here. Look at her. She's great, but she's gaining weight. Every time you see her, she's getting bigger and bigger. She's got personal chefs and personal trainers and personal this and personal that. I mean, if money could buy it, she would have it, right? Okay? I don't mean to be critical, but she's getting bigger every time you see her. Now, I'm going to mention some names. And if you don't know who they are, you'll have to Google them. Jackie Gleason. James Gandolfini. Fatty Arbuckle, President William Howard Taft, John Candy, Chris Farley, Mama Cass Elliott, Karen Carpenter. These people had it all. If you don't know who they are, you're too young, you don't know who they are, you can Google them or just take my word for it. These were people that were at the top of their game. Karen Carpenter had the voice of an angel. She died at 34 years of age, at 94 pounds, when her heart blew apart because of her anorexia and her bulimia. Mama Cass had the voice of an angel. She was part of the Mamas and the Papas. And she had her own career. She was at the London Palladium, and she was jamming a sandwich in her mouth and died at about 400 pounds. Fatty Arbuckle was a silent film star. Jackie Gleason was one of the greatest TV stars, greatest movie stars of his era. William Howard Taft was the president of the United States. He was so huge, so obese, that he had to have his bathtub brought from Ohio because the bathtub that is provided for him by the White House was inadequate to house his oversized derriere. You know how embarrassing that had? He couldn't get elected dog catcher today because of his size. But in that time, he had to have his bathtub brought out from Ohio because he couldn't get in the bathtub that's provided at the White House. John Candy, Christopher Farley, these guys were at the top of their games, and this disease took them out. This disease is mind over matter. It doesn't mind killing you, and you don't matter. Just work the steps, because not working the steps will absolutely mean that if you don't work the steps, you are flirting with death. If you have this disease is mind over matter. It doesn't mind killing you, and you absolutely don't matter. It's a vicious killer, and it gets worse over time. So the idea that a human power can relieve my compulsion is pure, unadulterated BS. Narishkeit in Jewish. Narishkeit means foolishness. Narishkeit. My father, he'd see me on Sunday morning, be watching wrestling, or I'd be watching the Three Stooges. He'd shake his head and go, Zenishkin nar, my son. Zenishkin nar, this Narishkeit. And that means don't be a fool. There was one show you could not watch in front of him, Hogan's Heroes. He couldn't understand when they saw the Iron Cross. My dad spoke very little English, but when they showed them the Iron Cross and people are laughing, he says, you laugh, you laugh? He says, you laugh? He says, you laugh? He says, I'm disappointed in you. I I said, Dad, they're making fun of him. He couldn't get it through his head. This is something you laugh at? This is funny to you? So that was the one show I couldn't watch. Anyway, I don't know why am I talking about, who cares, right?
Narishkeit,
right, yeah. He saw that iron cross and he's hearing a laugh track. He says, this is funny to you? You laugh? He says, you laugh? He says, this is funny? Okay, that God could and would if he were sought. What kind of God do you have in your head? What kind of God do you have in your heart that's not going to help you? Many of us have to redefine a job description for God. We have to sit down, and as fervently as we work a food plan, we have to work a God plan. We have to have a prayer plan. We have to have a meditation plan. And above all, for me, I have to have a God that I am willing to believe in, that I am willing to hold hands with as I walk through life. I'm too scared. I'm too immature to walk through life. I'm too frightened to walk through life without his help. I cannot do it. I don't know how. If I could have done this by myself, I would have done this by myself when I was 5 or 4. I would have done it, but I can't. So I need the help of a power greater than myself. What do I know about God? There is one, and it's not me. Very, very important for me to keep that in mind. For me, God is pure love and mercy. Pure love and pure mercy, and he loves me. Does that mean I get everything I want? You bet I don't. Does that mean that everything goes my way? No, it does not. There's nothing in the book that says, okay, now life is easy. It doesn't. You find that in there. You show it to me. You show it to me. Being convinced. Convinced of what? The ABCs. So I hope we took those ABCs and we made a greater understanding out of them. I hope that we now can amplify an understanding of those ABCs. Yeah, quickly.
Yeah, you kind of jumped over the B, because you said A was twist of mind and allergy of the body. B was...
That no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. That money won't do it. That things that are of this earth won't do it. James Gandolfini, he was the star of The Sopranos, died. This disease took him out at 51. Jackie Gleason, Mama Cass, Karen Carpenter, these were all people that had the money and the fame and they had the wealth and they had it all. They were at the top of their game, and this disease was no respecter of their earthly possessions or their earthly poverty. It took them right out. This disease doesn't care. It's mind over matter, and see that God could and would if he were sought. Being convinced. Convinced of what? The ABCs. We were at step 3, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that and what do we do? Let's clarify one of the misconceptions, because I've told you 2 and 10 are the most misunderstood. 3 and 4, excuse me, 2 and 10 are the most underutilized. 3 and 4 are the most misunderstood. So, we're not turning anything over to God in step 3. We're agreeing to do so in 4 through 12. 3 is the final terms of surrender. What does that mean when we say we're going to turn our will? Our will is our thinking, and our life is our action. So what are we turning over to God? We're turning our thinking, and we're turning our action over to the care of God in 4 through 12. We're turning our thinking and our actions over to God. What do you know of me? You know nothing of what I am. You know what I do. You know my actions. If I stood up here and tried to convince you to drink whiskey, you'd think I was crazy. You'd think, what's he coming here trying to convince us to drink whiskey for? But I'm coming up here and I'm talking about recovery. That's what I do, so that's what you know of me. I know of you only what you do. So we're turning our thinking and we're turning our actions over to the care and direction of God. Okay, very, very important. The first requirement is that we be convinced, I'm still on page 60, that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. you have to ask yourself if you're in recovery or you're not in recovery, is your program working for you? How are you doing with your way? How are you doing with your methodology? Life run on Harlan's way sucks. Life run my way just flat out sucks. And I can't even begin to tell you how much overwhelming evidence I have had in my life that tells me my life run my way is not a life worth living. How do I know that? My God in heaven, the nightmares I could tell you, the embarrassment that I've been through on self-will. Oh my God, my God, my God, my God. But my life run God's way is a beautiful thing. See, if I had a pill that would give you instant recovery, I would throw it in the toilet and flush it down. Not because I hate you, but because I love you. Because there is no way of life better than this. I'll get into that this afternoon when we do step 12, if I stop talking and start attacking. But I would not give you that pill because I love you and I want you to experience, oh my God, the places I have been and the people that I have met and the people that come into my life as a result of this program. It is it's a magic carpet ride. It is a magical carpet ride. I have sponsored psychiatrists and nurses and housewives. I have sponsored people that were bowling alley owners and street sweepers and surgeons and dentists. And I've sponsored two women from the adult sex industry. And I've sponsored people that were all walks of all manner of humanity. And it is the most amazing trip that I could even begin to tell you. If they learned from me one millionth of what I learned from them, they learned a lot. Because they touched my life in a permanent way, and touched my life in a loving way, and elevated my life with every call, with every contact, with every time we spoke. I got further away from food and closer to my God, and every one of them, I have the most respect, the most love that I can't even begin to tell you. What a magical mystery tour this is. You will not even believe where you're going to go when you hold God's hand and you start doing what he wants you to do and start working these steps in a way that maybe you've never worked them before. It is an amazing, amazing ride. Let's go to the first requirement is that we're going to now define the character defect of selfishness or the script. Selfishness. When we talk about selfishness in our 2017, we want all the marbles, we want all the stuff for ourselves, and that's part of it. But in 1936, 37, 38, 39, the book was written in 37 and 38 and was published in April of 39. So it's 37 and 38. What selfishness meant was that you have a script in your head. You're selfish, which means you want everybody to stick to your script. You want them to think the way you want them to think. You want them to do what you want them to do. And that's what selfishness means in this arena. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life on self-will can hardly be a success. And we've talked about that. On that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. The road to hell is paved with good intentions, isn't it? I was just doing that for your own good. How many times have we heard that? I was just doing that for your own good. Oh, really? You embarrass me in front of everybody because I'm fat and that's supposed to be for my own good? Yeah, I thought that would make you go on a diet. Oh, okay, thanks. With friends like you, who needs enemies? Okay. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. Is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet. Again, the ballet is not the ballet like in tutus or whatever. It's the whole thing of the play. The scenery and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, If only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest, but as with most humans, he's more likely to have varied traits. So I'm going to kiss your ass or I'm going to kick your ass, but one way or the other, I want you to do what I want you to do. I have a 22-year-old. I'll give you her cell phone. You can call her up. Tell her what you think she should do with her life. She'll let you know. Don't worry, she won't hesitate. Don't worry, she'll tell you. She'll let you know where you can stick all that stuff. You want to tell her what to do? Good luck. Good luck. What usually happens, now we're going to define the character defect of self-seeking, which are the actions that I take to try to get my own way. What usually happens, the show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that other people are more to blame. In other words, we blame others. There's four things alcoholics, Al-Anons, gamblers, compulsive overeaters, any addiction, there's four things we do, and we do them as naturally as we breathe. We lie. We assign blame. We keep score in our relationships. And we fight battles that just don't exist. We fight battles that just don't exist. We're mounting our steed every day. And we're out there. And we're on the battlefield with our lance. And we're going to charge into that battlefield. There's no one else there. No one else is. And we run that thing into a tree and we fall off the horse and we break our leg. How many times have we done that? How many times have we fought those battles that just don't exist? They don't exist. There's no one else on the battlefield. I had a woman traumatized. She was, this is an educated woman. She calls me up and she's crying. It was after the presidential election. I says, oh my God, I says, come on, you're, oh my Lord in heaven, this is a person with an advanced degree, you know, from the University of Arizona in Tucson. I'm thinking, come on, what the hell? She was traumatized. He says, come on, come on, you gotta live your life. You gotta live your life. Come on, snap out of it. So we work through it, and she's back living her life, and she's back teaching, doing whatever she needs. But, oh my God, you know, at times we, but you know why it's funny? Because I've done the same thing. Over nothing. Over nothing. Okay. He becomes, we are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker, even when trying to be kind? Okay? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? In other words, I'm going to get up in the morning about 15 minutes before everybody else, and I'm going to outthink you, I'm going to outmanage you, I'm going to outdo you, so I can get what I want. And I need a hunchback assistant, and I'll go, and I got the laboratory things going. I'm going to just, like Simon Bar-Sinister from Underdog. Remember him, Simon Bar-Sinister from Underdog? Okay. That was Underdog's archenemy there. Remember that? Okay. So I've got the things going, and I'm going to rub my hands together, and I'm going to get you, I'll get you, I'll get you. And the only thing that got me was fatter and fatter and fatter and fatter. That's the only thing that did. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants, and do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not even in his best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? You think they don't see through us? You're crazy. You can't lie to a liar, and there's no greater group of liars than right here. We've been lying to ourselves our entire lives. We've been lying to others, and we've been lying to ourselves. Maybe we don't like to think about that, but to have an addiction, the first victim of addiction is the truth. Remember, we talked about that this morning. And the bottom line is that you can't BS a BSer. They see right through us, just as we see through them. But we think we're so damn smart. We think we're so damn smart that they can't see through us. And we understand very little about what they're seeing and what they're doing. Our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. He is like the retired businessman who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation. The minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century. Politicians and reformers who are sure all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave. The outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged him, and the alcoholic who has lost all and is locked up. Whatever our protestations, are not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, and our self-pity? Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So in other words, we were the ones that set the ball rolling. We were the ones that put us in that position. So our troubles, back to 62, we think are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. Now, how much more of a warning do you possibly need? We must be rid of this, but how? God makes that possible. He makes it possible through the working of the steps. A broken brain cannot fix a broken brain. I am not going to decide tomorrow that I need to be rid of selfishness and willpower myself to be rid of selfishness. That's not going to happen. What's going to happen is I see the destructive nature of the selfishness and I work the steps and the selfishness is gone. My broken brain cannot fix my broken brain. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore. But we could not live up to them even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centered as much by wishing or trying on our own willpower. We had to have God's help. This is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that here and after in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agents. Thank you. We are his agents. He is the father. We are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. Now, we're going to take this apart a little bit. He's going to be the director. If you go to a show, you go to a movie, the director says, you stand over there and look happy. You stand over there and look sad. You stand over there and do this. You stand over there. The director is the director of how you're going to emote, how you're going to recite your speech, how you're going to do what it is you're supposed to do, because the director understands what is required here. Oftentimes, the actor doesn't. But the director knows you're sad. Here's why you're sad, and here's why you're mad, and here's why you're glad. Whatever that may be, it is up to the director. He is the principal. We are his agents. Now, a lot of people don't know what that means. I have a real estate license in the state of Arizona. And as such, I am bound by fiduciary duty to put the interests of my client above my own. And that means that if you hire us to sell your business, you hire us to sell your business, we must advance your needs above our own. We are the agents, you are the principal, and that is what I'm agreeing to do with God. I am agreeing to put the interests of God above myself. I am not going to put my own interests above God. I'm going to put God's interests above me. And that's what that means. Am I not in spiritual fitness enough to understand that he sees the big picture? I can't. I'm finite. I'm human. I've got blinders on. I can't see around corners. I can't see what's above me or below me, but God can. Am I willing to just for today trust that if I do certain things, that if I serve God, that it's going to be okay? For today I am. He is the principal. I am the agent. I put the needs and interests of God above my own. Now here's one that gets a lot of people upset. It says, he is the Father, and we are his children. And there are many people here who had wonderful fathers, but there are people here that didn't. Statistically speaking, because I know statistics of OA, I am in a room, and statistically speaking, there are people in this room that were molested. There were people in this room whose fathers were not so nice. They weren't there, or they were abusive, or they were whatever. This is my Heavenly Father, the perfect Father, the wonderful Father, the great Father. This is my Father in heaven, not my Father on earth. Now, I happen to love my dad, and my dad was a great guy. He was an awesome guy, my dad. If my dad had $10, he'd give you $20. If my dad had 20, he'd give you 100. My dad was a very generous man. My dad was a kind, kind soul. He had a spirit and a generosity. He was a storyteller. He was a joker. If you understood Yiddish, if you were just English, no, because it's hard to compete with you. Unless you watched that damn Hogan, no. But if you understood Yiddish, he was a storyteller and he was a joker. He could tell a joke like nobody's business. He could imitate Al Jolson like nobody's business. But the bottom line is that my dad was a great dad. But some of us have dads that weren't. And we have to keep in mind we are talking about our Heavenly Father. Okay, now let's take a look at the basic instincts of life before we go on. The basic instincts of life, when threatened, are the source of all fear and they are the source of all anger. And the basic instincts of life are going to be things that we're going to be dealing with when we hit our fourth step. So let's deal with them right now. God gave us the basic instincts of life so that we could live better and we could also propagate life to the next generation of humans. Let's take a look at history and let's take a look at what we know. Cavemen, Cro-Magnon man, Peking man, Heidelberg man, all forms of cavemen had a social instinct. They had the social instinct. They figured out through instinct that was imbued into them by God and by living their life that they could live better by living together. They were safer from attack. And let's just say, for example, that Janine, you and I, we're going to wait behind this tree, and Amy and Sue, they're going to run that yak or that wildebeest through here, and when the yak comes through, we're going to hit it on the head with our sticks, and then we'll split the food with everybody. So they learned that by working in cooperation with each other, they could live better and they could survive the trial spots ahead. This social instinct is imbued by God. Now, I have a daughter who's 22, but when she was not 22 and she was in Coco Pop Middle School in Scottsdale, Arizona, I used to pick her up from school every day. Very, very seldom would she be in the back seat chattering with her friend Brooke Wolf about science or math or whatever, or English or whatever. Who likes who likes who, who's going to the sleepover, who's not invited to the party, who is invited to the party, who are you going with, what are you wearing, blah, 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 yeah, blah, 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 about all these social things. When she was in sixth grade, at Cocopa, seventh grade, eighth grade, they would yak and yak and yak and yak, and very seldom would Pythagorean theories come up, or what's the other theory about the right triangle? It's obtuse. And
Pythagoras.
What's it?
Pythagorean.
Pythagorean. They wouldn't be discussing the Pythagorean theory. They'd be discussing the sleepover. My ex-wife would go out and spend a lot of money on clothes, and then half the girls in the neighborhood would be wearing what we just bought my daughter. That's a girl thing. I never understood that. I would never walk up to a man and say, gosh, can I borrow your pants, or can I borrow your shirt? Would never do that. Would never cross my mind. I mean, never. That just doesn't compute with me. It doesn't make any sense. But this is a girl thing with the clothes, and we'd buy the clothes, and my ex-wife, her name is Esther, and we'd open the door, and there'd be somebody coming in, and, wait a minute, didn't we just buy that jumper or that blouse? And then my daughter would say, yeah, I loaned it to Molly. And, well, call the Goldners and make them buy their own kid clothes. What do I have? I'm not the clothier here. I'm not the clothier of Scottsdale, North Scottsdale here. What the hell's going on? So the social instinct. If you want a good explanation of the social instinct, go to any high school, go to any grammar school, or go to any middle school at lunch. Who sits with who? Who's with who? So if we have that social instinct, if it's anything like what I have, like let's just say I'm friends with Dean, or is that your name, Dean? Dean and I were friends, but I see you guys trying to take Dean and you don't want her to be my friend anymore. You're taking away what I already have in the social instinct, and that's gonna scare me, and that's gonna upset me and make me mad, and I'm gonna lash out at you. You're gonna retaliate in kind, creating pain and suffering for me, and that's gonna bring me into fear, and that's gonna bring me into anger. It's gonna trigger the mental twist. But let's just say, for example, Dean and I are friends, but I want to be friends with Sue and Barbara over here. I don't really want to be friends with Dean anymore. I want to sit over here at this table with Sue and Barbara. That is my ambition for the future. But all of a sudden, Amy goes over there and tells Sue and Barbara not to let me sit there because I'm a bad guy. And she's trying to convince them not to be friends with me. She's upsetting my ambitions for the future in that area. And that's going to make me upset. That's going to make me scared. That's going to upset me. I'm going to lash out at her. And then she's going to lash back at me, creating pain and suffering for me. And then I'm going to end up eating M&Ms and Chunky Bars. Okay? Now, the social instinct also has another subset to it, and the subset of the social instinct is self-esteem. Now, I don't know how else to explain this, but self-esteem, I am not what I think I am. I am what you think, what I think you think I am. I am what I think you think I am. Now, right now, I'm talking, and some of you are listening. That makes me feel pretty cool. Some of you are sleeping, some of you are listening. But the bottom line is I'm talking to a room full of people, and it makes me feel like you think what I'm saying is worthwhile, so it helps me like me. Does that make sense? Okay, self-esteem. So there's two parts. Any emotion that I, or any instinct, excuse me, that I tell you about, not only in the present tense, if you take it away, is going to make me angry. But what about my ambitions for the future? It's also going to make me angry. So if you upset my ambitions for the future, I'm going to get upset, and those emotions are going to boil up. And when those emotions boil up, they're going to cause me pain and suffering, and I'm going to be in trouble. The second of the instincts is the security instinct. And the security instinct has to do with pocketbook and emotional security. Pocketbook is the number one area. This is imbued into us by God, who teaches us, even as far back as the Old Testament, that if we have $10, we don't spend $10. Now, I'm all for living one day at a time. I think living one day at a time is great. However, I hope I'm not the only one in this room that has a savings account. I hope I'm not the only one in this room that has a life insurance policy. I hope I'm not the only one in this room that has a little bank account set aside for their kid, or kids, as the case may be. I have an HLG account, Hannah Leah Grabowski, and every once in a while I throw a little money in there, because one day, it's gonna come soon, she just gotta rope up a likely prospective, she might come and say, I'm getting married. Well, I better be ready, because it's an inevitability. It's not if she's gonna get married, it's when. So I better have a little something set aside. And I have a savings account for myself, and I have a profit sharing or a SEP fund. I can't have profit sharing, I work for me. I have small employee pension. I can't have a, like some of you have a pension, I can't have that. I have a small employer pension, which I put in money myself for me. So these are the things that I do to provide for that rainy day. Boy, I used to live in Eugene, Oregon. It rains there all the time. You better have a lot of money. No. But the bottom line is that these are the things we do, and we work hard, and we give some of it to charity. Hopefully we give some to help others. These are instincts imbued into us by God. But if you're going to upset the way I make my living or my ambitions for the future, then these things are going to come to disturb me, and I'm going to try to create pain and suffering for you. You in turn are going to retaliate creating pain and suffering for me, and then these emotions are going to build up and I'm going to have a problem. Now, as a subset to financial security, there's also emotional security. If you upset my emotional security, you're going to incur my wrath. So as such, if you do that, I'm going to lash out at you, or my ambitions for the future in emotional security, okay? Now, you all get that it's not just what we currently have in that area, but it's our ambitions for the future in that area, okay? Let's say, for example, I don't work for me, but I work for you, and there's a promotion coming up, and I see you talking to Barbara over here, and boy, I'm hoping you're not talking about that damn promotion, because I want that promotion. I'm going to all of a sudden go out on a fact-finding mission to find out what you and Barbara were talking about, and I'm going to do everything I can as a fact-finder to find out what's going on with that damn promotion, because that has to do with my ambitions for the future in the area of pocketbook. Now, there's one other little subset of the security instinct, and that is personal security. In other words, somebody comes in here with a gun or a knife, you know, and they look threatening, they look like they're going to hurt one of us. Well, that's going to make me scared, because I have, not only do I want to live now, I want to live into the future. So those are things that are imbued into us by God. And that's part of the reason, not part, that is the reason that we just instinctively are aware of these things when we feel threatened. That's our uh-oh voice. We used to teach my daughter, don't ignore your uh-oh voice. If your uh-oh voice is going off and you feel yourself in a dangerous situation, act on it, call one of us. Don't be afraid to reach out. If your uh-oh voice is activated, it's probably trustworthy. Don't ignore your uh-oh voice, okay? We used to tell that to her all the time. Now, when we were a wee. But the bottom line is, these are very important. Now, the last of the instincts is the sex instinct. And we all have the sex instinct. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. And as far as the sex instinct goes, again, if you came to Coco Pond Middle School in Scottsdale, Arizona, you would find clusters of teenagers talking about who likes who likes who like likes who like likes who's with who talked to who texted who called who. You'd hear all these things incessantly, to the point where you'd probably want to jump out the window at some point, as I have often done. But the bottom line is that this is what you would hear. You'd hear it day and night. Night and day, this is what you would hear. And so-and-so is a jerk, and he broke up with so-and-so, and now I'm not going to go out with him because he was a jerk, and he did this, and he did that. You just listen, and you shake your head, and you hope that it passes soon. And the bottom line is that this is the sex instinct. So if you take away what I currently have, or you upset my ambitions for the future in this area, you're going to upset me. And this is exactly what happened in my marriage. We were married 17 and a half years, and my wife came home and she said, I have fallen in love with a man that I met through the office, and I really want to marry him, and that means I have to divorce you. And I tried to talk her out of it, but I couldn't do it. She divorced me, and she's with him and been with him ever since. That was a very hard conversation to have. It really did a number on me psychologically to lose my wife to someone like that. It was just very, very difficult psychologically. So these are the basic instincts of life. Unfortunately, though, we have to take a pee-pee break, because if I don't, I'm going to be very embarrassed. So let's meet back here in 5 minutes, no more than 5 minutes.